Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Robert Wright, best-selling author of Non-Zero, The Evolution of God, and Why Buddhism is True. He's also co-founder and editor-in-chief of bloggingheads.tv and meaningoflife.tv. And you can learn more at nonzero, one word, nonzero.org. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on why no is not enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book, Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Nick Kristoff and Cheryl Wu Dunn on the deaths of despair that show up in their book, Tightrope. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. And for most of those 3 years, this is where I usually plug participation. Organizations that I think are worth checking out are indivisible.org, moveon.org, couragecampaign.org, which is a organization in California, Five Calls, that's the number five and the word C-A-L-L-S, fivecalls.org, which tells you some timely and relevant calls you might want to be making to your representatives, and Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are going to be holding meetings back home and you can meet them in person. This being an election year, I encourage you to get involved, not only with specific campaigns that you believe in, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure all Americans their right to vote, as if the future depends on it, because we can tell it certainly does. Now, as we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part in facing down that pandemic by social distancing and in looking for ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation that's now unfolding. A couple of words about this current moment. I happened to turn on Trump's press conference this past Monday, a couple of minutes in, I think. The first words I heard were, "So what did I do?" And he's responding to Fauci's weekend confirmation that a swifter, more competent response would have saved lives, and the damning, well-researched New York Times article about his administration's wasted 4 to 6 weeks as the pandemic took hold in this country. He brags about his no entry from China ruling, which specifically denied entry to foreign nationals who had traveled in China in the last 14 days. Not exactly a ban. It allowed 40,000 to return from China. And this was at a time when we already had cases here within the states and cases coming in from elsewhere unscreened. But since it is the only thing he has to brag about, he does so constantly. Now, worse, he goes on to attack the press in this particular bit that I watched. It was relentless, and attack and belittle Joe Biden as feeble-minded. And about then is when I turn it off. This is not an essential public health briefing. This is a scurrilous, mean, lying narcissist with no sense of the human heroism or the human suffering taking place in this crisis, running for re-election. I lasted, as I said, about 2 minutes. I thought I could already see where this was going, but it turned out to be worse. This one included the propaganda video with clips of words of praise from governors dependent on the federal government for any number of life-saving actions. And the frustrating thing for me is I feel it's no longer enough to shudder at his latest desecration of the American sense of honor and conscience, not while so many are risking their lives and not while partners and family members are losing loved ones without even being able to say goodbye. He is poisoning the heart of America while he is breaking it. The value of his handling of the pandemic will only be judged by the results. Despite the courageous and competent actions of so many governors, other state and local officials, healthcare workers, first responders, and the American people, the results, as measured in cases and deaths, is horrific. Now to today's conversation. Robert Wright doesn't shy away from thinking or talking about things that matter, couple of examples. In his book, The Evolution of God, he makes the point that our conceptions of God change with political conditions. When the Jews were harshly enslaved, God was vengeful. When they lived in relative peace with their neighbors, God was more beneficent. So how does that play out in religion's contemporary influence on politics, whether in ISIS or America's evangelical right? How is it at play in American Christians' embrace of Donald Trump, a prodigal, if there ever was one? Then in his book, Non-Zero, Wright contends that evolution and history move toward greater and greater non-zero sumness, which I translate as greater and greater cooperation, collaboration, win-win outcomes. So how does he explain the resurgence of tribalism in America and around the globe, and the win-lose outcomes in the racist, anti-immigrant, anti-environmental attacks of Trump and his base? And specifically at this moment, you have to note that the American people usually come together when confronting huge challenges. Think of World War II or the attacks of 9/11. Even the Vietnam War in its early stages, though as it wore on, it divided and ruptured this nation. Natural disasters, for the most part, bring out our best as citizens and as neighbors. Rebecca Solnit has written a book about this, Paradise Built in Hell, which I highly recommend. But today, in the face of the global pandemic of COVID-19, we are divided on nearly every aspect of the crisis, how serious it is, what steps we need to take to confront it, what sacrifices are worth it and who should take them, who's in charge of our response, even what to call it. And today, when I'm talking with Robert Wright, we'll talk about how this has happened, what it means, what comes next, and how we might get past it. Robert Wright is an intellectual activist in terms of, as I said, big questions, big conversations. His books include Three Scientists and Their Gods, Looking for Meaning in an Age of Information, a book that I discovered, his first book written in the late 80s, I discovered, not even sure how, but found really fascinating. The Moral Animal, Non-Zero, The Logic of Human Destiny, The Evolution of God, and his latest, Why Buddhism is True, The Science and Philosophy of Meditation and Enlightenment. He's currently president of the Non-Zero Foundation, visiting professor of science and religion at Union Theological Seminary in New York, and co-founder and editor-in-chief of two online series, Blogging Heads TV and Meaning of Life TV. Welcome again, Robert Wright, to Freeform, a World That Just Might Work.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Terrence.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Wednesday, April 15th. First of all, Bob, how are you doing? Where do you live? What's the pandemic like where you are? How are you coping with the chaos and the isolation? How's your family doing? That sort of thing.
I can't complain. I mean, I guess the bad news is I live in New Jersey, a state hit pretty hard. The good news is I'm not in one of the worst hit counties. I'm kind of in the middle level in terms of badness. I live in Princeton. The town has lost a few people to COVID, including last week, a well-known mathematician at Princeton, emeritus, John Conway, who invented what's called the game of life, a cellular automaton. But we're fine. It's not a bad place to be at all. I have a daughter in New York City, but she'll be leaving there pretty soon. She's fine. I've worked at home since the 1990s, so that part's not new. I can no longer swim every day. The YMCA is closed, but I'm finding ways to get exercise, so I don't have anything to complain about at all. There are a lot of people in much worse shape, you know, not just in America, but around the world. And we're talking on the day that it was either this morning or yesterday, Trump said that he was going to cut funding the World Health Organization.
That's
at a
right.
Time when, you know, there are countries we don't need the WHO as desperately. Some countries we do benefit from its information gathering and distribution services and so on. And honestly, we could have benefited if we had wanted to by getting its tests back.
That's right.
When we were still fumbling trying to generate ours. It had tests available. It was giving to other countries. But still, there are countries in much worse shape than us financially that need the WHO much more. And just the whole idea, just the very symbolism, mm-hmm. of cutting funding amid a pandemic is like, you know, I thought I'd run out of
mm-hmm.
ways to get people around the world to hate America, but it looks like we have a new one here.
Yeah, and we are, by the way, the largest funder of the World Health Organization.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, we are.
And so when we step aside at a moment like this, it's, yeah, as you say, it will have both the real world consequences of the lack of funding, and then the consequences in terms of our role in the world.
Just, and you know, the WHO's performance wasn't perfect. I actually wrote a piece about this, which is on the mm-hmm. nonzero.org site. If we want to influence it constructively, we should wait until the pandemic's over, have an investigation. And if you want to use funding as a threat to get reform, do it then, fine. But what's probably going to happen is China's going to step up.
Mm-hmm.
I would suspect somebody is fill the gap. And then we're just going to have less leverage than ever. There's just no dimension along which this makes sense. I don't even think it'll work for Trump politically. Maybe I'm wrong. But obviously what he wants to do is blame the WHO, blame anybody but himself for his own inaction. More and more, they're going to start blaming Anthony Fauci, I think. You're seeing signs of that. They're blaming China, whose response, again, probably a lack of perfect transparency at the beginning, and there are things to criticize, but their response was so much more effective and capable than ours, all things considered. So anyway, that's Trump.
Yeah. Yeah, no, as I think, you know, where you're coming down there is sort of as I did, which is that although for certain voters in November may not remember, the ultimate critique is the results. And the results are that we have more cases, more deaths, higher spikes, et cetera, et cetera. That's if you're taking the temperature of the pandemic in America, that's how you take it.
Mm-hmm.
I want to return to the China question later, but I'm going to take an interesting tack, I think, which is that it is currently, let me just give people a little bit of the timeline. On the 31st of January, that was the day that the Trump administration announced it would deny entry to foreign nationals who traveled to China in the last 14 days. On February 29th, so a month later, first U.S. death. March 11th, the NBA closes down. And for me, that was the day, the night, when everything shifted, I think. March 13th, Trump declares the national emergency, and the Pelosi-Mnuchin First Response Act passes the House with Trump's blessing. And it is a month ago, March 15th, that the CDC recommended gatherings of 50 or more should be canceled for the next 8 weeks. So we're kind of a month into this phase. Just over a month, let me ask you, what do you think's working?
Well, I mean, clearly the social distancing is working. I mean, it kind of has to in a way, you know, if there's enough distance between two people, the virus can't spread. And you know, I was in New York City. This would have been about I think it was around March 12th. It was right when things were happening. I remember that it was about the time the NBA was shutting down, which really got my attention.
Same here.
And I mean, but for one thing, I'm a little bit of a basketball fan, not, you know, but just the whole idea of a major, professional sport just shutting down. And you know, at that point in New York, you know, the subways were a little less crowded, train into New York's a little less crowded, but it wasn't that dramatic. And then I haven't been back to New York since that day. But the scenes you see of the streets, it's just so dramatic. If you've never lived in New York and seen the normal density of human beings on the sidewalk, the density of people in the subway, you can't really appreciate what a dramatic shift this is. It's so dramatic, it has to have a very significant effect on the rate of transmission. And you are definitely starting to see that in the statistics. Even deaths, which are the final indicator to show up, are leveling off, if not declining. At the moment, they seem to be doing that in New York and in the United States and in the world at the moment. Now, mm-hmm. new mm-hmm. hotspots can arise and so on. But I think it's clear that social distancing works. Unfortunately, I mean, we're talking about a social distancing that entails the shutdown of a lot of commerce in a way that will ultimately have bad economic effects. So the challenge is going to be, how do you start things back up without reigniting the contagion in ways that allow more people to get back to earning a living. That's, of course, going to be the next big challenge. We know now that if we largely shut down the economy, we can stop transmission. But this virus is so stubborn that unless you really stomp it out pretty much entirely, it can always flare up and likely will if life returns to anything like normal. So that's the next big challenge.
Yeah. In other words, I've seen, I think now maybe for a month or so, that the form it seems to suggest to me is a 18-month roller coaster of suppression, easing, some rise, suppression, easing, some rise. And the reason I say 18 months is that I think we're in this pattern for the most part, although there will be growing immunity, but we're in this until there is a vaccine.
Yeah, pretty much. And, you know, now I think it's possible in principle, if you get the virus down to a low enough level and you get in place something we don't have now, which is plenty of tests both for infection and for antibodies to see if somebody has ever been infected. If you have enough of those ready, they're the kind that give you instantaneous results, not results 5 days later. And you have a regime of contact tracing in place so that when you find somebody with it, you can locate pretty much all the people they've been in contact with and notify them and so on. At that point, you can, in principle, keep the risk so low that people could go to restaurants and so on and without real concern. But you have to have those things in place. And if we leave it to the federal government, honestly, I don't know if this administration can ever muster the sheer competence.
Yes, no, I understand what you're saying. That, and when you say sheer competence, you mean the minimal. In other words, it doesn't mean they have to have all the right philosophies or anything, but competence. In other words, I sort of wrote at one point, you know, what the four things we need in a leader, and leadership might be number one, but competence, I think, would be number two. Inspiration, you know, would be nice, Roosevelt, Churchill, that sort of thing. But competence would be essential. And it does seem that they don't aim for it, nor do they achieve it. And one thing, let me throw this one out to you. It's that I've been looking at the admiration that Trump has for strongmen and authoritarian leaders and, you know, one person power. That's no doubt about that, but the actual willingness to put that power to work for good, to actually marshal the federal government to do what it could do, that runs into his other belief, which is a sort of a hatred of the federal government.
Yeah, and and I also think there's been a little hollowing out of competence, because who wants to serve in this administration? The capable people who started out with him eventually get fed up and leave, you know. So, and then there's the fact that, you know, the guy just can't stick with it. He has trouble sticking with a plan. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's obviously hard for the people working for him, like Fauci and so on, the ones who mean well, to get him to agree to do something in the first place. And then you've got, his degree of actual commitment. When he started having press conferences, he was like shaking people's hands. Hey, that's not being a good role model, Donald. And when he announced the mask thing, he says, the government is now recommending you wear masks, but I'm not going to wear one. Well, I mean, you know, it's just it's so problematic. Now, the good news is that the states are taking matters
That's in
right. their own hands. The West Coast governors, Northeast governors getting together for Trump felt very threatened by that and tweeted some bizarre stuff about mutiny, but he's going to let it happen. He has no real choice, I think, constitutionally. But so there's hope there. So we'll see.
Yeah, one of the things that I've looked at here also is that, as you know, we're both familiar, I'm sure, with the Naomi Klein's work on the shock doctrine, mm-hmm. and Milton Friedman's notion that you don't let a crisis go to waste. And it seems, were we to have a competent president and a competent administration right now, I think this would be a reverse shock doctrine moment. That is to say that people who've had all their doubts about the value or the worth or even the need for a strong federal government would finally see, in the way that climate change demands it over time, a pandemic demands it with urgency, that the government do well. And if we had a government doing well right now, I think it would be, a bit of a leverage point, not a complete reversal of that trend, but a bit of a leverage point. But in fact, at this moment when we need government and we need government to work, we're having to look to the states. Now, perhaps the fact that we have the contrast between the federal administration and, say, California with Gavin Newsom, as well as several others, that maybe people can see, when it's in good hands, it does work. When it's not, it doesn't. Any thoughts there?
Well, I think that's true. I also think there's a particular argument for federal leadership. In this case, if you assume competent federal leadership, you yep. mentioned climate change. There's another kind of analogy between these two. I mean, climate change is something that demands not only good national governance, but global governance. It's a global problem, and it's not in the strictly rational self-interest of any nation to be the only one that makes the sacrifice, right? Because the benefits are distributed globally, the sacrifice is local. That's why you try to get international agreements. As with many of these problems that transcend national bounds, whether it's overfishing of the seas or, a pandemic, if it's a problem that transcends borders, then the logic of collective action dictates that the level of governance be appropriate to the reach of the problem. So there's two things here, which is, first of all, leave aside global governance in the case of a pandemic, just any one region, if it's the only one addressing it adequately, that's not going to be enough even for its own purposes. Like if these governors in the Northeast do a great job of containing the thing, but the states on their periphery don't, then the virus is going to come back in. This is a collective problem. And that's why you do need some degree of strong leadership at the federal level, because if some states address it well yes. and others don't, then even the states that address it well are going to suffer, not to mention the states that don't. So this is a problem that is just intrinsically not local. Some problems can be locally mm-hmm. Address. My local government is doing a great job of getting water to my right. house. I don't need global governance to get electricity. And even some kinds of pollution problems yep. like pollution of a local pond, those can be handled at the local level. But something like a pandemic is not only is it not adequately treated at the local or state level, it's not adequately treated only at the national level. You need cooperation ultimately at the level of the whole planet. And so we have two problems here. We have a federal government that's not capable, competent, or inspiring national leadership, and a federal government that is constitutionally averse to international cooperation, and in fact just cut funding to the one international institution charged with dealing with problems like this.
Right. I interviewed Yuval Noah Harari, author mm-hmm. of Sapiens, last year. And I find resonance between some of your writing and thinking and his in places and so on. And he points out that the three biggest threats we face, and this was before the pandemic, which would go as number four, is nuclear war, climate change, and the sort of the larger area of technological disruption. And all are potentially existential crises, all call for cooperation, not just with the nations, but globally. And yet he had predicted a movement towards greater and greater cooperation. And I think in Non-Zero, that was what you were tracking as well. And yet instead we have this resurgent entrenchment of division and tribalism. Let me ask you to, we'll get into the specifics again of the pandemic, but this whole notion of how we got from what seemed to be a movement towards greater global cooperation, towards this renewed tribalism, how is it happening and what does it do to your thoughts of this longer, bigger picture trends you've been watching?
You're right. In the book Non-Zero, I argued that there were more and more issues that could only be well addressed at the level of global governance. To the problems you mentioned, I would certainly add the problem of biological weapons, because they are can be as deadly as nuclear weapons, and they're harder to control. We're going to need really innovative global governance to deal with that. But in any event, you know, these are, we're talking about some actual existential threats that call for a degree of global cooperation that we're just not getting. And in fact, as you suggest, we're getting in some ways the opposite, more and more tribalism, sometimes between nations. And right now, Trump is seeming to want to foment a nationalist antagonism with China. And sometimes at the, you know, kind of intra-national level within nations, you know, and we are famously tribalistic now in the United States with, you know, political polarization and so on. And this is always a threat because there is, you know, yes, the world does have a lot of non-zero-sum problems. That is to say, games that can either lead to win-win outcomes if we address them successfully, or lose-lose outcomes. Like if we don't control nuclear weapons, have a nuclear war, that's lose-lose. So a non-zero-sum game doesn't have a guaranteed positive outcome by any means. The whole point is it can have such a negative outcome that you should be motivated, if you're thinking clearly, to cooperate to reach the positive outcome. Now, one of the dangers we face derives from the fact that the world has always been full of zero-sum games too. Human evolution, although it did give us the equipment, the mental equipment to cooperate, it also gave us the equipment to fight and contest things. I mean, for example, people status is a zero-sum game and people seem driven to seek status. And sometimes there are shortages of food. There's only so much food and it's a zero-sum game to get it. So the brain, the human brain evolved to play both zero-sum and non-zero-sum games. And the problem is that it is sometimes in the interest of, or a problem, it's sometimes in the interest of politicians to trigger the zero-sum parts of our brains. That's what Trump is trying to do with China now. Mm-hmm. They are the enemy. We are the good guys. And it's a horrible time to be doing that in the middle of a pandemic. We need as much cooperation as possible. But that part of human psychology is always there. In the realm of politics, he triggered it. This part of psychology to get elected. The
for sure.
The nefarious coastal elites who have contempt for ordinary Americans were the enemy. So were some foreigners, you know, immigrants and so on. And that helped get him elected. Now, I don't think it's only Republicans who are guilty of this. And I think the resistance, the so-called resistance to Trump, has too often been too tribal for its own good.
Mm-hmm.
And
let me see if I track you with that. In other words, if cooperation is what's needed and tribalism, the political tactic of one side, if you on the other side, given a choice of ways to respond tribally, you may be standing to the specific point you're talking about, but you're basically playing on his turf.
That's right. And I think in terms of the resistance, you're very often pushing the buttons in his base he wants pushed. If you say Trump supporters are just racists, they're going to hate you more than ever. And that's what he wants. And yeah, are there some racists? Sure. But I personally think there's some bigotry in all of us and it's a constant struggle. But in any event, there are a diverse set of motivations for voting for Trump. Three of my four siblings voted for Trump.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
This is my confession. Yeah. and they had different motivations.
Uh-huh,
one of them just wanted to, quote, throw a wrench into the works.
Yep.
He was fed up with politics. For two of them, it's largely about abortion. They're conservative Christians. So it's just you're doing him a favor I think the mainstream media does him a favor sometimes by doing so much editorializing in the headlines that it's easy for him to convince his supporters that everyone, including all media, are arrayed against him. And sometimes they are biased against him. Anyway, that's a, you know, the newsletter I do now, the Non-Zero newsletter, it's the one you can see the contents at nonzero.org. That started out as something called the Mindful Resistance newsletter because I thought the resistance just wasn't mindful. Mm-hmm. First of all, in the just straightforward English sense of the term mindful, like careful, deliberate, attentive. Yep. And I also thought, tactical. And I also thought that, you know, I had written this book on Buddhist meditation. And I also thought that for those people who do meditate, mindfulness meditation could help you get in a frame of mind where you would respond to Trump in a more constructive, productive way and in a less counterproductive way. But, you know, it's funny. I wrote a piece in the newsletter about Steve Bannon in the last issue, and I got chastised. It was clearly critical. You know, there's no danger of mistaking it for a puff piece, but I got some, you know, pretty far left guy chastised me in a DM on Twitter for not calling him racist, you know, not. And I just, it's not always productive. I'm just very reluctant to call people racist. I think it's a complicated issue. I rarely have great confidence what's actually going on inside their brains.
Of course.
I think, you know, there's a famous Bible verse. It's in both Paul, a letter to Paul, but it's also in the Old Testament because Paul is alluding to the Old Testament. It's like, if your enemy is hungry, give him food. If your enemy is thirsty, give him drink. And then that's quoted often. The next line isn't. The next line is, for by doing so, you will pour burning coals on his head. In other words, at least my interpretation of that is sometimes it's tactically sound to be nice to your enemies. Yeah. There are other arguments for doing it, including profound moral ones that I think are also part of the Christian tradition. But it's worth keeping in mind that sometimes not reflexively attacking your enemy is a good offense.
That's right. If your eye is on the prize and not this round of the fight, you know. So let me tell people, this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Robert Wright, best-selling author of books that take on big ideas, including Non-Zero, The Evolution of God, and Why Buddhism is True. And I think we've referred to bits of all of them already. He's also co-founder and editor-in-chief of Blogging Heads, that's one word, Blogging Heads TV, and Meaning of Life, one word, .tv. And you can learn more at nonzero, one word, without a hyphen, nonzero.org. Let me say a couple of things. One is about the trashing his base. It was my feeling that we can look at the Russians, we can look at Comey's letter, we can do all sorts of things. But in the last 2 weeks of the 2016 campaign, it seemed to me that it was all about Trump's unfitness. It was all anti-Trump. And I imagined a member of Trump's base going, you people, you Clintons, you elites, you Obamas, you know, you think I'm worthless. You think I'm crap. Here finally is a billionaire, a major player in this country who stands up for me, and all you can do is attack him. You're attacking me. And I felt that nothing would have assured their getting to the polls more than that relentless attack on the one sort of big shot who seemed to be their guy.
Yeah, I think the campaign was, you know, Trump's campaign was fear-based in obvious ways. The immigrants are coming to, you know, to rape your daughters and whatever. But Hillary Clinton's campaign was pretty fear-based. It was fear of Trump. And a certain amount of that was certainly appropriate. But I kind of felt there needed to be a little more of a positive vision. And then, of course, there was her infamous deplorables remark, which was, I think she would agree, was ill-advised in retrospect. And that's just red meat for him. Yeah. I mean, they, you know, I was talking about Steve Bannon. I've been, he's used the pandemic to resurrect himself. He's got this.
Yeah, we're going to go. We're going to go.
Anyway, right now, I noticed he uses the term deplorables as a term of endearment. He refers to Trump's base as the deplorables. They have totally embraced that. They have totally embraced it.
Yeah, because it not only, it doesn't just say we're in this together. It says, and they hate us.
Right.
Yep, exactly. Okay, so let's talk a bit about this. You published this article a few days ago, the title of which was Steve Bannon and the Struggle for America's Post-Pandemic Soul. You can find it at nonzero.org. What is it that you're trying to bring to people's attention? Let me tell you, I was aware of some of it, but not some of the specifics. So,
well, I started listening to his pandemic podcast. This is the way this started. I'm doing kind of a weekly thing on my own. My own show on Blogging Heads is called The Right Show, and it's there's a audio podcast version of it. And I've resurrected conversations with a guy who co-founded Blogging Heads TV with me, named Mickey Kaus, who has gone on to disappoint me and some of his other friends by actually supporting Trump. And we're doing a weekly thing that gets into the pandemic a little, and mainly gets into the pandemic. So I started listening to the Bannon podcast, and I couldn't believe the extent to which it was just about bashing China. Mm-hmm. And I looked into it, and part of it is that he now, it turns out, has a patron who is a Chinese expat who's been indicted by the Chinese government. He's in America, and he's a billionaire, and so on. I think that's some of it, but it's also the fact that Bannon knows an effective talking point when he sees one, especially a fear-based one. And I realized that the Republicans, maybe more than we realize now, may in the election go all out China phobia. I think different candidates will handle it differently. I mean, Trump, it turns out, has some donors who don't want him to do that.
That's right.
Sheldon Adelson, who would love a war with Iran, doesn't want one with China because he has casino interests in Macau.
Yep.
But anyway, it's a very potent thing. Trump has every reason to want to blame somebody other than himself for the pandemic. The Chinese government, they are doing things that are reprehensible, deeply
that are,
reprehensible
that are bashable.
With the Uyghurs, you know, the Muslims and everything. So, so it's kind of a difficult thing to explain to people why, you know, you should do what you realistically can to address human rights issues in other countries. Sometimes there's not much you can do. But in any event, you know, arousing Chinese nationalism against us, I assure you, is not part of the solution to human rights issues, because that tends to strengthen authoritarian leaders.
By the way, that's what you just said plays on an international level, similar to the way what I said about playing tribal politics nationally does.
In other absolutely.
Words, you feed the authoritarian at home or the authoritarian opponent abroad.
It's the same dynamic.
Yep.
And then there's a broader lesson here that I tried to bring out at the end of the Bannon piece. What this is an example of the pandemic, that is again a problem that calls for global cooperation to address it. And yet in its nature, it can be used to arouse the very kind of tribalism, in this case, nationalistic tribalism, that impedes global cooperation. And when you think about it, like all of these problems that call for global cooperative solution can be used in that way to arouse nationalism. You know, they're not doing enough to address climate change. So we're not going to either. Or you're right, there's a threat of bioweapons, but rather than try to come up with an effective treaty, we have to attack them and as with Iraq, you know, address a weapons of mass destruction problem that turned out to be non-existent by invading the country. Almost all of these international problems that call for international cooperation can be harnessed to arouse nationalism that will impede this very kind of solution. So we're that's why I called the piece Steve Bannon and the Struggle for America's Post-Pandemic Soul, because this crystallizes the issue. Are we going to respond to these issues that call for this kind of cooperation in a nationalistic way that impedes the cooperation or not? And this question is not yet answered in this case.
Yeah.
And the question is going to recur again and again with climate change, controlling various kinds of weapons,
yep,
and various kinds of environmental problems, various kinds of transnational problems. And so I think we really need to start thinking about how you fight back against the Steve Bannons of the world. And it's challenging because yes.
I was going to just say, you quote China scholar Ali Wynn, and I loved her the way he put it, and it's right near the sum of your article, which is that transnational threats will increase the urgency of global cooperation, as well as the power of those forces that inhibits mobilization. That both are there in right. at every moment. Let me. By the way, I highly recommend that, because we should people look at that article by Robert and see what Bannon's up to, because we know that Trump is usually not disciplined enough to fully follow Steve Bannon's lead. But Steve Bannon is, I remember I mentioned it to you off air, that when it was probably his biggest profile media appearance was when he was on 60 Minutes interviewed by Charlie Rose, Steve Bannon, Charlie Rose. How long ago was that? Yes. I thought he just took Charlie Rose to the cleaners, he was playing chess while Rose was playing gotcha checkers. You know, you said this, but then this stuff. And Bannon was making these much bigger arguments. And I remember his last line was, there will be a populist revolution. What he was addressing there was the folks who are left out of our society, the folks who see no future, the ones who end up in these deaths of despair that I mentioned at the top of the show. And from that tinder will come a populist revolution. It will either be from the right or the left. And Bannon's working for the right.
Complicated thing about him is he makes some appeals to the left more than Trump.
Oh,
you know,
yes.
He wanted to tax the rich, I think. I think he actually advocated for that. He says he did within the White House. He's an economic populist.
Yep.
An economic nationalist populist. And part of his message can appeal to the left. In fact, on his podcast, he's saying, okay, now that Bernie's out of the race, welcome aboard.
Over.
You know, because their factories have undercut your wages, and some of that's true. I mean, what you do about it is another question.
That's right.
But he is
a true economic populist, whereas Trump is
that's
just
right.
mouths that stuff but doesn't deliver.
That's right. And Bannon, he's a complicated, formidable figure. I don't know if you've seen the Errol Morris documentary about him, American Dharma. It's been streaming for about 5 months now. There was a similar thing where you go into it thinking, you know, surely this man will be exposed. And I don't mean he comes off great, but he's a formidable figure. And
I got
the sense that Errol Morris felt that he didn't corner him the way he might have liked.
Uh-huh. So put him on the list with Charlie Rose. Yeah. Let me bring another angle on China. I don't think of myself as a China basher, but I have been thinking about China taking the lead in the world's response to climate change for a while. What it might mean if we, especially in America, have been such poor stewards of democracy, of the democratic form, that we allowed Citizens United, we allowed the democracy to be bought off by money, we allowed gerrymandering, we allowed all these things so that it no longer actually has the strength that it could. And having been such poor stewards of democracy, it then takes an authoritarian system more able to pivot quickly, more able to mobilize at will to turn the global tide. Well, once it decides to act, an authoritarian government has these advantages. Their disadvantage is their need to control bad news, which leads them, in this case, with the pandemic, to withhold or delay telling the truth to the public or even to themselves. Now, the U.S., a representative democracy, should not have to overcome that same obstacle of the lack of transparency. But here, in this administration, and all too often in others as well, you see the worst of both worlds. Denial and deceit that leads to delays, followed by weak and ineffectual federal response. If China ends up, I mean, from this point forward, they botched the beginning, but from this point forward, they may be in a position to lead in supplying global needs, right? And they're owed enormous debt. They may very well take the lead, as you've mentioned, in restoring the global economy. Their economy could open sooner and stronger than others because they went through this first. So I end up asking the same question as I did with climate change. And this is a big question. What will it mean for the way society is organized if China is the world leader in both of those existential crises?
That's a good question. I mean, on climate change, I kind of feel any leadership is better than none.
That's what I'm saying, though. But what,
it's
do it, but in so doing, authoritarianism is the solution that works.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the question that you're raising is to what extent does Chinese influence through these avenues, global influence through these avenues, make authoritarianism seem appealing, or what other ways does China cultivate authoritarianism beyond its borders? I don't really know the answer to that question. I mean, I do think one big problem we're making is, you know, there are plenty of people in America concerned about Chinese influence displacing American influence, but a lot of them are focusing on military matters exclusively. Mm-hmm. And I think they're overstating the degree of actual threat. You know, China is a, there's a tendency to attribute to leaders we don't like, whether they're authoritarians or whether we find them threatening for some other reason. There's a tendency to view them as crazy. We do this with Iran all the time. Mm-hmm. We act as if their leaders are like irrational. Actually, they have a very rational foreign policy given their ends. It's not hard to predict. So with China, I think we imagine them using military power to try to conquer the world or something. I don't think that's their plan. I think they want to prosper and do what we've been doing, which is assert a kind of economic dominance. Now, in the case of Taiwan, there may be a real risk of military conflict. And there are, you know, perils in the immediate vicinity of China in that way.
In the South China Sea, there's stuff going on.
Although I think you have to say that if they think that a rising power deserves to have a sphere of influence that extends somewhat beyond its borders, that does not distinguish them from what has traditionally been the American philosophy. Mm-hmm. You may have heard of the Monroe Doctrine, not to mention,
Manifest Destiny.
Yeah, Spanish American War, all kinds of things. So I'm not saying that's good. I wouldn't applaud. I don't really applaud it when we do it, but we have to view it, in a kind of a balanced way. We have to and ask ourselves whether this really is a sign of like a uniquely malicious government. The fact that they have certain kinds of aspirations, we have to be clear on what cases are they likely to use military force in, and in what cases is it a struggle for more what you could call soft power? I think that's where we're deficient. Like this, the World Health Organization thing is a perfect example. Mm-hmm. Now, if China swoops in and fills our shoes on the funding front, wouldn't shock me. They're going to have the influence that we have now surrendered. Not to mention just the goodwill of the people around the world. I mean, remember, a non-trivial part of America's national security problem is just people not liking us. If people like you don't have a terrorism problem, I wish, and I think this is what you're suggesting partly, is that we should be taking the lead in a lot of these areas if we want our system of government to be the most influential role model it can be as appealing as it can be internationally. Now, of course, at the moment, our democracy is not working all that well. That's another problem.
That's the point I'm making, I'm linking the two of them.
Yeah.
That we have been such poor stewards of democracy that it cannot deliver what it should. That authoritarianism is always going to have an advantage. I was interviewing Jared Diamond on his book Collapse. You know, remember the one of how certain societies deal well with environmental issues and don't. And we talked about China. China at one point had some horrific floods that actually affected 250 million people, which when you think about it is staggering, staggering. And the question was, why were these floods so devastating? The answer was deforestation. The government said, stop it. Uh-huh. And pretty much it stopped. You know, there was no timber lobby that delayed it. I can remember many, many years ago, Dana Meadows, who wrote Limits to Growth, she said, America seems to have about a 3-year gap between when it makes the right decision and when it actually implements it because of the battle between the lobbyists and the interests that oppose the right move. And eventually, you know, maybe we'll do it. Authoritarian governments have an advantage. So if we give up our advantage of being perhaps more innovative, we have more access to ideas and so on because of our openness and so on, that if we sacrifice that to moneyed interests and things that will be a drag on our ability to move forward, then we cede the field to that other approach.
Yeah. No, in my lifetime, our government has become more and more ineffective, it seems to me. And one thing people don't appreciate about China, it's definitely not a democracy, but there's a form of what you could call pluralism, which is that when citizens get really outraged about something, they organize and they use, information technology to organize, cell phones or whatever, to get in touch. And there's a fair number of actual protests that actually lead to change. That local grievances get addressed in China to an extent that I think would surprise Americans. And on balance, I'm not convinced that America does a better job of solving certain kinds of problems that afflict its citizens mm-hmm. than China does. Now, again, China's doing some really horrible things. Mm-hmm. I want to mention the what they're doing with the Uyghurs again, because that's just almost uniquely bad in terms of things going on the world today. Yeah. But I think if you're really concerned about a country like that expanding its influence, you have to be honest about what it's doing well and what you're not doing well. Mm-hmm. And we are not a very inspirational role model right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Trump is not the cause. Trump is a symptom.
Right.
Of this weakened, beleaguered, fractured democratic system. And as I said, this pandemic and the call for a government response in the hands of, I'd say, an Obama would have provided the possibility of a reawakening of a stronger, more able democracy. But I think if you look at, what's happened, I think the second half of the headline about your Bannon article, the post-pandemic soul of America, I think that is what's up for grabs, whether it's from Bannon and his attack on China and his efforts to re-elect Trump, or any other question. The question of our flight from each other toward living off of screens. If you could do worse, if you were writing a science fiction novel that wanted us to mutate into disembodied persona, then have social distancing to battle a pandemic.
Yeah.
I mean, so let me just, we've got about another minute or two. Any last word from me, the biggest reason I reached out to you was this thing of how when we need to be together, we're more tribal than we have been in ages. Any sort of last words of what's bubbling up for you these days on what to look for or what to hope for?
you know, I'm honestly looking myself. I'm kind of wondering how you address the problem I outlined in that article, how you overcome the tribalistic tendencies and get busy solving some of these truly existential problems. And I mean, I would invite your listeners, if you have ideas, there's you can email us at nonzero.news@gmail.com, N-O-N-Z-E-R-O. That's the email of the newsletter. And you know, maybe there are things happening that I'm not aware of. Maybe there are groups of people who can network, who can join together. I'm really doing a little soul searching myself right now, asking myself, like, what form of kind of messaging can I do right now that is most effective? You know, and it's challenging because it's easier to get attention by being tribal, whether it's internationally tribal, being nationalistic, or domestically tribal and just full-throatedly denouncing Trump and building up your Twitter following. And I do denounce him sometimes on Twitter, but, you know, as I said, beyond a certain point, I think it's counterproductive. And so I'm, you know, I'm looking for ways that, you know, a kind of like a tribalist tribe can can win.
Yeah. Oh, you know, then we're very much in sync on that, Ben. I mean, these questions, I mean, one way that it's occurred to me, Bob, is of all the things Trump has done, the bungling of this pandemic is the one that is, you know, taking people's parents from them and taking people's mm-hmm. wives and husbands and children from them. And we don't know how many more, but many more will die because of the way it's been handled. And how do we march in the streets, which I think if this were happening at a time when we could march in the streets, this might be the kind of thing that would actually provoke people to march in the streets.
That is a fascinating irony. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah.
You know, how do we march in the streets when we depend on staying in homes to fight the pandemic? And the other second thing, which goes right with that, is how do you confront this? I mean, he should be removed from that podium. You know, he should not be allowed to be running those rallies in the name of public health. And yet, when his whole thing is based on a tribally fired up base, you know, anything, even if we were marching in the streets, you know, blah, blah, you'd be just igniting that reaction. I mean, I also am just like, what? These are challenging times.
It is a very subtle challenge. And, you know, there is human nature has in it this noble, idealistic, loving, altruistic thing part that you can appeal to. It can be done, but it's challenging because there's another side of human nature. And lately, yeah. I think the bad guys have done a good job of exploiting it.
Yeah. Okay. So again, some of the books are Non-Zero, The Evolution of God, Why Buddhism is True, and the website to see the latest of what Robert's up to and to get involved is nonzero, one word, nonzero.org. Give the newsletter email address again.
It's nonzero.news, news@gmail.com.
Very good. And for this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and transcripts, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 to 10 articles that flesh out the conversation, email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y, @mac.com. You can also sign up at my site, and you can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most major podcast sites. You'll find years of podcasts there and at my site. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, on and on. You can also follow me on Twitter, @McNallyTerrence. Thanks to G. Lee and Mark Maxwell, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. Most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Finally, thank you again, Robert Reich. Keep up the good work.
Thank you, Terrence. You're doing God's work. Keep it up.